What are your impressions of how tonight went for you?
Bad, pretty plain and simple. It didn't go well. We didn't pitch well. Home runs and walks are not a good combination. We're giving up too many of both. We got some young guys and bullpen some experience. That's about it. You look at our bullpen, it's extremely young. We got two guys with more than 3 years of service, and everyone else has got 1 year or less. There's going to be some growing pains, and we've seen some of those growing pains the last couple of days. We don't have a lot of youngsters here. Dixon Machado's a youngster, but position players, we don't have a lot of youngsters. That's just the way it is. The staff in general has been giving up way too much home run and too many home runs. That's not a recipe for winning.
I definitely would expect probably Brock to win it, just because my personal philosophy is, as a quarterback, it takes at least 2 or 3 years to have a basic level of understanding of NFL defenses and offenses to be able to operate proficiently out there on the field, especially in week one. It'd be asking a lot. Now, I could be totally wrong. You know, I might be going on a limb here, but I think that they're grooming Brock to be the starter in week one.
We know that the NFL and the NFLPA have a relationship that is at times and perhaps perpetually dicey and icy, and there's sometimes a lack of eye to eye between the NFL and the NFLPA. So it's scary to think that we are still almost 2 weeks away from the actual appeal from Zeke Elliott, and yet we are already having these words that are now in the court of public opinion and paint a very disconnected picture between the NFL and the NFLPA.
If domestic violence weren't so serious, this whole thing would be laughable. I mean, think about it. You've got the NFL, the masters of getting ahead of the story. Let's not forget Spygate, Bountygate, Deflategate. Now publicly accusing someone else of leaking information in a personal conduct case. I mean, it's just hard to wrap your head around that. But what's happening is the league wants to control the narrative as long as it can before Ezekiel Elliott's hearing at the end of the month. And remember, the league has been criticized for the way it has handled domestic violence cases in the past. Clearly, the league is sensitive to public perception here and is trying to win in the court of public opinion before the hearing comes down.
Now, you guys make all these predictions about everything, about guys that are going to be great players that have been here for 2 years, and who's going to win all the games, and I don't even know why we play. Why do we even play? Why do we even have practice? Why do we compete? Why do we coach guys? How they need to improve? I mean, you guys got all the answers to how guys are going to be, what they're going to do. Sometimes I wonder, why do we play? Why do we even have practice? Because you guys got all these conclusions already drawn about who's what, how good they are, what they can do. Why would you ask me? I mean, I read stuff all the time like, well, that's nice to know. I mean, where'd that come from? And then you ask me? But Christian Miller has done a nice job. He's had a really good camp. He's doing a good job. Had a lot of production points in the scrimmage. We're really happy with the progress. And, you know, thanks for asking.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Yes, indeed. It is the extravaganza right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Where we are, Toledo's sports leader. Hope you're having an outstanding day today. We are having an outstanding day. It's a can you dig it kind of a day.
Can you dig it?
Yes, indeed. Having a fantastic one, and really, really looking forward to a couple of really good conversations today. Coming up in just a bit, we are going to be talking to Dennis Manilow about a couple of things. The rumor coming out of the NBA circles, Cushman, we talked about it yesterday toward the end of the show when it kind of broke. We got to talk about it more today now that it's had 24 hours to simmer and stew. LeBron James is leaving Cleveland at the end of the year. Where is he going? Nobody knows. Is he going? Nobody probably knows. But the strong report from NBA reporter Chris Sheridan is that it is official. He is heading out of Cleveland. He doesn't like working for Dan Gilbert. We know they had their issues prior to him returning to Cleveland anyway. Now that Kyrie is going to be going as well, there would be no big three to stick around for and sign another 1 or 2 year deal. And perhaps he wants to go and expand his brand out to the West. And the place that he called home, if you recall, place he called home in a tweet about a week ago when he was invited to go up someplace in Seattle, Washington, and visit friends. And he said, yeah, next time I'm home in L.A., I'll definitely come up. Whoa! I thought home was Akron, Ohio. Wait, what? Yeah, home is L.A. Does that mean that he is on his way to join Lonzo Ball, Brandon Ingram, Brooke Lopez, and we all talked about this. Maybe, depending on what happens this season in Oklahoma City, maybe PG-13, putting together another nice little super team, if you will, out in L.A. Nobody knows. But Chris Sheridan, sports writer, NBA reporter. He has covered the NBA for some 18 years or more. His own website now, Sheridan Hoops, is what he runs. And he said very specifically yesterday that an NBA source that he trusts told him LeBron James is 100% leaving Cleveland. Now, almost immediately after that, NBA writers in Cleveland said, that's bullcrap. Joe Varden, who covers the Cavaliers for Cleveland.com, said, for what it's worth, three sources close to LeBron said to me that this latest tweet about him is 100% false. Varden said, I have more. Three sources said paid particular attention to LeBron's relationship with ownership and said LeBron does not view it that way. Talking about the animosity with Dan Gilbert over not only previous issues but also political differences, as Dan Gilbert gave a bunch of money to Donald Trump's campaign in the presidential election and LeBron James openly campaigned for Hillary Clinton, et cetera, et cetera. And Varden also tweeted, one of the sources close to LeBron said to me there is no NBA source who could speak on his behalf in the way that it was reported. Chris Sheridan has certainly been dressed down, has he not? Not so much, because Chris Sheridan doubled down on his report and said today, and I quote, if I may quote, Chris Sheridan said, one follow-up tweet on LeBron leaving Cleveland next summer. Denials from his reps are disingenuous. They will slash must lie to protect his image. And that's where we stand. Is the king on his way to another throne someplace else after the season? I have been saying it for several weeks now, long before even Kyrie announced that he wanted to be traded, that yes, I believe LeBron James is leaving Cleveland after this year. And it's Kyrie knows it. And it's one of the reasons why Kyrie said, I am not going to get stuck left here behind without him. Then blamed for all of the shortcomings that we have without him. I'm going to beat him out the door. Hey, Dan, trade me. Get me out of here now. I'm not going to put up with this. And thus the world turns in the NBA surrounding LeBron James. So we're going to talk to Dennis Manilow about that coming up at about 3:35 this afternoon. Then coming up at 4:10, we're going to shift gears entirely. We're going to go to baseball. Ashley McLennan, Tigers writer, blessyouboys.com. We're going to talk about Ian Kinsler, who had a friendly little handshake with Angel Hernandez today. We're going to talk a little bit about Brad Ausmus. We're going to talk about Miguel Cabrera and other things associated with your Detroit Tigers. So that is coming up with Ashley McLennan at 4:10. In between now and then, and in between those conversations and after those conversations, you can hit us up, well, any way you like. Dial 866-240-1065 whenever you want, 866-240-1065, and we'll put you up and on the radio. If you'd like to tweet to us, do it at Sports Radio 1065. Facebook us at 1065theticket.com if you've got comments. A lot of good stuff to talk about in addition to those things, including you just heard Joe Thomas, future Hall of Fame tackle, for the Cleveland Browns, who has blocked for some 20 or 22 or 23 different quarterbacks.
I lost count, too.
Since 2007. Yes, he has blocked for so many dudes back there. I'm sure every voice, every quarterback who has ever called a signal from the line of scrimmage in front of Joe Thomas, I mean, those voices all probably run together. He probably hears Red 88, set, and thinks it's Bay. That's Brady Quinn back there. Nope. That was a few years ago. Is that Johnny Manziel? Nope. Is that Derek Anderson? Nope. That's Ed Carson? Nope. It's just so goofy. He says Brock Osweiler is going to be the quarterback. He said they're grooming Brock Osweiler to take over, and you know what? It's probably the smart thing to do. I don't want to ruin DeShone Kizer. Who did I talk to yesterday, Jim, who said, no, let's throw Kizer in there right now? Oh, it was Adam Stites from SB Nation.
Yeah.
He said, throw Kizer in there right now. If he can't handle it mentally, then he was never the right guy in the first. I'm not a believer in that philosophy. I'm okay with Osweiler. Field Yates, Jim Trotter, you heard that on the Ezekiel Elliott appeal. And you know what's getting a whole lot of attention today is not the Ezekiel Elliott appeal. What's getting a whole lot of attention today is his former coach at Ohio State, Urban Meyer. Urban Meyer, who said some things that are not necessarily helpful. Let's just put it that way, not necessarily helpful to Ezekiel Elliott as he gets ready to appeal this suspension to an arbitrator. Urban Meyer talked about how concerned he was for the troubles of this young man. Kind of making it sound like I know him pretty well, and my boy Ezekiel Elliott does have some troubles. And that's a real concern to some. Stephen A. Smith talked about that today, and I want to play you some of that response. I thought it was very interesting that it's a bad look for Ezekiel Elliott. I can understand that argument. I'm going to talk about that a little bit, and then, of course, you heard the Nick Saban rant. And you know what? Just because it was the last thing that you played, Kush, I want to play it again now, and I want to respond to it.
It's kind of like a reliable backup the last few years. What have you seen from him kind of emerging?
I don't know if you're going to hear that question very well. Let me try that again. Let me play this again from the top. The reporter is asking about a linebacker for Alabama and asking Nick Saban about what he expects out of him, that kind of thing. Let me see if I can lift that volume a little bit. One more time here.
Christian Miller is a guy that y'all have relied on. It's kind of like a reliable backup the last few years. What have you seen from him kind of emerging? It seems like he's going to be one of those pass rush guys. Christian Miller.
Oh.
So pretty interesting question, I think, from the reporter, Christian Miller. You know, it's kind of question I might ask of, Paul Keels, if I talk to somebody, who's close to the Buckeye program, or if we were to get Coach Meyer on, tell us about this guy. He did some things for you last year. What kind of a role is he going to have this year? Seems like he's a pass rushing kind of a guy. You think you'll get something out of it? Pretty simple question for a press conference. Nick Saban's response about this Christian Miller character is this.
I don't know. You guys make all these predictions about everything, about guys that are going to be great players that have been here for 2 years and who's going to win all the games. And I don't even know why we play. Why do we even play? Why do we even have practice? Why do we compete? Why do we coach guys? How they need to improve? I mean, you guys got all the answers to, how guys are going to be, what they're going to do. Sometimes I wonder, why do we play? I mean, why do we even have practice? Because you guys got all these conclusions already drawn about who's what, how good they are, what they can do. I mean, so why would you ask me? I mean, that's a project puzzling to me. Why would you ask me? I mean, I read stuff all the time like, oh, that's nice to know. I mean, where'd that come from? And then you ask me? But Christian Miller has done a nice job. He's had a really good game. He's doing a good job. I mean, had a lot of production points in the scrimmage, so we're really happy with the progress.
Okay, thank you, Coach.
And, thanks for asking.
the assembled media around Nick Saban's little podium up there laughed and tried to make some light of some things and, add a little humor to it. It's like, coach is funny. coach is joshing with us here. They laughed to avoid the embarrassment of what Nick Saban was doing. They laughed to avoid the Delta Bravo-like. If you understand what Delta Bravo means, what the initials mean, you can figure that out for yourself. I won't say them on live radio. I will say the second one. That's code for the word. The last one is code for the word bag. You figure out the first one. He's such a Delta Bravo to the media about a very fair and normal question. They figured it's either flip him off and say, why are you being a jerk? It's our job to ask questions. Or they laugh and chuckle and say, he's just kidding with us. Coach likes us a lot. That's Coach Saban up there. He runs Tuscaloosa. He owns Alabama. All except for Auburn anyway. So we've got to laugh. We've got to chuckle because we don't want to get on the bad side of the coach. Truth of the matter is, what that was? That was Greg Popovich, College Football Edition. We have talked on this program, Kush, you and I, many times about reporters who ask dumb, ridiculous, inane questions that a coach just wants to look at him and say, how did you get your job? Why are you putting that microphone in my face and asking me that question? It's like giving the sideline reporter the job of asking an NBA coach like Popovich, the job of asking him a question in 30 seconds for question and answer from the end of the third to the start of the fourth quarter, right? and in the third quarter, your team just gave up, 42 points, and you're down by 15 or 20. And the reporter says, "Coach, how important is it to tighten up the defense here in the fourth quarter after that third quarter?" What the hell do you want him to say? Oh, no, not very. I thought that defense was just tight enough, giving up that tight 42 in the third quarter. No, it's not very important at all. What the hell do you want me to say to you? How important is that? I was watching last night. I was watching the results show for America's Got Talent. I don't know if you ever watched that show. But Tyra asked one of the judges after somebody got through to the next round, and Tyra asked one of the judges, maybe it was Simon Cowell, how important is it for whatever her name was to pick up her game and take it to the next level in the semifinal round? I thought, did you work in the NFL as an NBA or as a sideline reporter? What do you expect him to say? Not very. I mean, just keep it at a flat performance. Make sure you're right at the plateau that you are right now. Don't get better in the next round because the competition won't get any harder at all. What do you mean, how important is it? Tyra? What do you mean, how important is it? It's damned important. What do you want me to say here? This wasn't one of those. This wasn't a reporter's fault. Legitimate question. Coach Christian Miller, tell us what you expect out of him this year. You got some out of him last year. He's kind of a pass rushing guy, it looks like. How much contribution will he make this year? He's basically asking a pretty good question about the depth chart. How much will he play, and what are your expectations of this particular player? Normal question, as the media does what the media is supposed to do. Ask questions of the coach and or coaches and or players and write a neat little summary to feed the beast. The beast of Crimson Tide Nation, to feed all Alabama fans everywhere who read these guys' stories, summaries, camp updates. Let them know how they feel. Let the fans know how the coaches feel about the players that these fans all watched, so intently on signing day 2 years ago. That's the media's job, write a little story, tell everybody how things are about their favorite football team. And for Nick Saban to just go, "Why are you asking me? You guys do all the predicting. You guys obviously know what's going to happen. Why are you asking me?" is just so filled with baggery, if you understand the rest of that. It's just so contemptuous. I know that reporter wanted to flip him off. And I know everybody in that room probably wanted to say, "What's your problem, bully? Why are you bullying us? Telling us, talking down to us like we're 5-year-olds. Just because we don't make $15 million a year to coach college football doesn't mean you get to talk down to us like that. But instead, it's going to be, "Coach, he's funny. Coach is funny. He really likes us. He's just funny."
I don't know. You guys make all these predictions about everything, about guys that are going to be great players that have been here for 2 years and who's going to win all the games. And I don't even know why we play. Why do we even play? Why do we even have practice? Why do we compete? Why do we coach guys? How they need to improve? I mean, you guys got all the answers to, how guys are going to be, what they're going to do. Sometimes I wonder, why do we play? Why do we even have practice? Because you guys got all these conclusions already drawn about who's what, how good they are, what they can do. So why would you ask me? That's a problem that's puzzling to me. Why would you ask me? I read stuff all the time like, that's nice to know.
It's nervous laughter. They're not enjoying this. They're not like, "Coach, you're really funny." No, it's nervous laughter because you're being a jerk on camera in front of a microphone, in front of all these reporters. And nobody in Tuscaloosa's got the balls to call you a jerk. So they're just going to chuckle a little bit.
Where'd that come from? And then you ask me? But Christian Miller has done a nice job. He's had a great day. He's doing a good job. Had a lot of production points in the scrimmage. So we're really happy with the progress.
Okay. Thank you, Coach.
And, thanks for asking.
It was a 13-second question from the reporter. It was a minute 17 of asshattery from Nick Saban. Why, when that reporter asked that question, why wouldn't the here's the question again, just to put a cap on this.
Christian Noah is a guy that y'all relied on as kind of like a reliable backup the last few years. What have you seen from him kind of emerging? It seems like he's going to be one of those pass rush guys. Christian Miller.
Oh.
So Christian Miller, he's been kind of a reliable backup guy for the last couple of years. He looks like he might be kind of a pass rushing guy. What do you expect to see out of him? Why didn't Nick Saban just say this? No, not that part. This part.
He's doing a good job. I mean, had a lot of production points in the scrimmage, so we're really happy with the progress.
Why didn't he just say that? Christian Miller? Yeah, he looks pretty good. He's doing a pretty good job. Had a lot of production points in the spring game. We're really happy with his progress. Why the rest of it? This is why some people, Chris, you remember when we did the story about a week ago? It was a really stupid poll because it only ended up getting like 14 coaches polled in the survey, but it was who is your least liked coach? Who is the least liked coach in America? And that's the reason we got the story, because it was Harbaugh was second.
Right.
Was Harbaugh second and Saban first, or vice versa?
I want to say Harbaugh was actually first.
Maybe Harbaugh was worse, and Saban was second, which is kind of interesting, again, because it's always the most successful people that are hated and you know, a lot of jealousy. But anyway, even though the poll was kind of stupid, the survey was stupid because it's such a small sample size, this would be one of the reasons why somebody would hate a coach like Nick Saban. No reason at all for that disrespect. No reason at all for treating the media. That media member, that reporter, probably writing a game story about certain guys at certain positions, or not a game story, an article, an update article on camp for his newspaper or whatever he writes for, and is featuring a certain position, maybe linebackers or defensive line or whoever Christian Miller plays. And he's talking about kind of a pass rushing guy, and he's got to include this in his story. Simple question. And he gets treated like that. He didn't play the, you know, coach, how important is it to improve this year card. He didn't ask the stupid reporter question, and he got to treat it like that anyway. That's the kind of thing that makes you just, I can't stand Nick Saban. I can't stand him for that kind of a reason. For lying to people about leaving Miami and going to Alabama. For lying about pretty much everything that he ever says, and then acting like a big spoiled jerk like that. You know what I mean?
No, yeah, I absolutely do. And we've had these conversations. You brought up when earlier this year we were talking about Greg Popovich in a similar kind of vein. And
especially post-game. You know, I understand his disdain for the sideline questions, especially when they're lame.
Oh, and they almost always are.
They almost always are, yes. But post-game ones, too, when legitimate game. I've got to write a game story here. Coach, you had to coach the game. That's your job. I've got to write a story that tells the fans what happened, how it happened, and how you feel about it. That's my job. Tell me how you feel about it and how you analyze it without being a jerk. That's what Popovich does, and obviously now that we see, this is, again, the kind of thing that sometimes super highly successful coaches who feel like they're bigger than the game, they own the game, they own the room. That's just how they bully people.
Yeah, and to some of what Nick Saban was actually saying, you know, you guys have all these, you know, projections. Why should we even bother playing the game? Newsflash for you, Coach. The readers, listeners, viewers, and fans want those projections. Otherwise,
exactly
they
right.
wouldn't be done.
That's exactly right. It's their
and deep
job.
Down, you know that too, Coach.
And here's the thing. How do those writers and reporters make their projections? By not only watching film themselves,
right.
watching games, but by asking you, Coach, tell us about this guy.
Yeah.
Because when you tell me about Christian Miller and what kinds of plans you might have for him, how he's doing, maybe where he is on the depth chart today, where he was a week or two ago, that will make my prediction, which the readers of my newspaper or publication want, a little more accurate. And I'll quote you and say, Coach Meyer says he likes this about this player.
Yeah.
That's how we do the job, for crying out loud. Why
right.
do you have to be such a tool?
Yeah, and it's just the nervous laughter you're talking about, you know. There's no reason for that. Besides, in this case, too, especially, I personally didn't think that, you know, that question was stupid. That wasn't one of
no.
those stupid questions. That
no,
was
really
a legit,
wasn't.
You know. And in most college, you know, situations, it's not like NFL training camp. A lot of times they don't let let reporters and things into a college training camp practice session. I know in years past for season previews, we've had on Voice of the Buckeyes, Paul Keels, talk Buckeyes in that vein.
Yeah.
And every time he had just, well, you know, we're not allowed in there, but because, and that's kind of the way it is for college sports. By the way, side note, so yeah, so we can laugh a little bit. You made a little funny joke earlier when talking about Joe Thomas. I went ahead and counted it for you. 18 different starting quarterbacks for the Browns since he's been drafted alone.
Wow. That's amazing. I mean, we know the number is up in the 20s from 99 since they came back. That's the big long jersey, the long jersey list thing
yes.
that we always talk about. But Thomas himself is blocked for so many, it's not even funny.
All right,
we
got
to get to Dennis Manilov here, so let's get our Buffalo Wild Wings stat of the day.
ESPN 106.5 The Ticket presents the Wild Stat of the Day, brought to you by Buffalo Wild Wings. Wings, beer, sports.
Buffalo Wild Wings stat of the day, Giancarlo Stanton had his consecutive home run streak snapped yesterday at 6 games. And even though he might be on pace for 60 home run season, he's still 2 away from a different record. That record was home runs in consecutive games. Still stands at 8 now, held by 3 players. Dale Long of the 56 Pirates, Ken Griffey Jr. of the 93 Mariners, and Stanton's current manager, Don Mattingly, who did it for the 87 Yankees. That is your Buffalo Wild Wings Wild Stat of the Day. Much more coming up, including Manilov next, right here on ESPN 106.5.
Now back to the Bob France Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Yeah, buddy, 3:40 now, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. We are Toledo's sports leader. Thanks for joining us. We'll get you on the phone line as soon as we can at 866-240-1065. But for now, those phone lines are closed because we got some time with our friend Dennis Manilov, who's going to talk to us about a couple of things out Cleveland way. If you are a Browns fan and or a Cavaliers fan, I think you'll be interested. D-Man, what's going on, brother? How are you?
Bob France, thanks for having me on.
Always a pleasure to have you on, Dennis Manilov. Hey, Dennis, let's get to the simplistic stuff first, and then we'll spend a little bit more time on your favorite player in Cleveland sports, which, of course, would be the King. But let's talk about a guy who's not anybody's favorite player out there, and that would be Brock Osweiler. A lot of people didn't want him to be traded for, didn't want him to be around if they did make a trade for him. It was buying a draft pick, a lot of people thought of, but now he's been named the starting quarterback for the second preseason game. And Joe Thomas, the Hall of Fame tackle who's blocked for 18 different future Hall of Fame, of course, blocked for 18 different quarterbacks in his time with the Cleveland Browns. He has said it looks like they are grooming Brock Osweiler to be the starter at the start of the season. You okay with that?
Sure. That means we can have all these bad puns. Brock, you like a hurricane. Brock of ages, all these stuff. Bob, you're supposed to laugh at that.
I did.
Listen. You laughed under your breath.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. I've always said this, Bob, that the coaches know more than we do. As much as we want to know, we think we want to know stuff, we think we know stuff, and we think we can read people.
Not according to Nick Saban, D-Man. According to Nick Saban, we know a lot more than they do. The reporters know a lot more than they do. Do you hear his ridiculous rant, his tired act dressing down a reporter asking a legitimate question?
Right. The Saban act is long tired, even though he's a great coach, one of the greatest college coaches of all time.
Amen.
But here's the thing. Hugh Jackson knows more about his quarterback room than we'll ever know. Oh, by the way, he's paid to know that. It is his position of expertise. So whatever Hugh Jackson tells me about the quarterbacks, I'm going to believe. Until and unless Jackson's proven wrong. Now you could say, well, what about Kessler? Why did he say Kessler was a guy that, you know, to trust him on? All right, so far he's been proven wrong on Kessler, but I don't believe that he was necessarily bullish on Kessler to begin with. I think he just had to say that because he was bringing RG3 in. Right. But that's a topic for another day. The bottom line is, I'm sensing that Jackson is going to go with Osweiler to start the season. He wants to go with a veteran who's got some credentials. He really likes Kizer. You can see that Jackson has taken Kizer under his wing, so to speak, and is grooming him. And he believes in Kizer, basically 100%. But I am sensing that he realizes there's growth here, that he still has things to work on before he can turn over the keys or he can be handed the keys to the starting job. And you know how it is with the youngsters, with the rookies. You don't want to give them the job or have them, you know, say that they earned the job and then have to take it away from them. So I don't think that Jackson will turn to Kizer until and unless he's convinced that Kaiser's ready to rumble. In the meantime, you've got Osweiler to hold the place.
And I think that's right. And I think that he's kind of almost the perfect type of guy to hold the place. Although he's got 21 starts, I think, under his belt. He would like to be a starter somewhere, clearly. He would like to hold on to that and not just be the placeholder for DeShone Kizer. He has a chance to do that if he plays exceptionally well. The DeShone Kizer debut is pushed back further. He's got a chance to do that, so it's kind of a win-win. And if he doesn't, you at least, you know, let him take the lumps while Kizer learns, you know, from the safety of the sideline. And I think that is a perfect scenario. Now, the question that I also have for you is who is either one of these guys going to throw to? Corey Coleman did a pretty nice job of defining what a number one receiver is a couple of days ago, talking to the media, and talked about how that's what he wants to become, but he isn't that. He defined a whole bunch of things that he isn't yet. Kenny Britt will never be. He's 7 years in, and he's an average, 45, 48 catch guy at a career high 68 last year. He's not a number one receiver. Is there a deep playmaking, consistent, reliable threat for Brock Osweiler that he'll have to be able to rely on?
Not that we've seen so far, Bob. And obviously, they have high hopes for Coleman, but he has not proven to be. I mean, first of all, Coleman's got to stay on the field. Secondly, he's got to, grow as a receiver, learn the route tree, be able to run all of the routes in the route tree, not just the fly route, So, Coleman's got a lot of proving to do, most importantly with his health, his ability to stay on the field. They feel like they've got a reliable second option, if you will, in Kenny Britt. They're sliding Duke Johnson, perhaps, into the slot. Every so often in camp, and maybe that's going to be something they're going to go with during the regular year. But as you know, I mean, that still leaves that number one, that proven number one out there. Who is it? I don't know who it is right now. I mean, you've got other guys fighting it out for a spot on the team, such as Hollywood Higgins or Lewis or one of those guys. But it is not a wide receiver room that just bursts with can't miss.
Yeah.
I mean, so that is an issue.
No question about it. Now, let me go to the other side of the ball real quick, and then I'm going to get to the LeBron story. Greg Williams, is he just, I don't know what the motivation here, unless it's pure 100% honesty, when he says Myles Garrett is unlike any rookie he has ever seen. He's coached in the league for 27 years. He said he's never seen somebody adjust to the NFL as quickly as Myles Garrett. My question is what the hell has he seen him adjust to? He's in camp under practice conditions. He's had one preseason game. That's an awful lot of high praise for somebody who's going into preseason game number two, has not played a full quarter in the National Football League, not played a single down in a regular season game. So what do you make of Garrett's really, really over-the-top praise for Myles Garrett?
Well, and I mean, coming from Greg Williams, whom I have the utmost respect for, and I can't wait to see what he does. I mean, it is a tremendous, vote of confidence. To get it from Greg Williams is a great thing if you're Myles Garrett. Granted that it's camp, but everything you see and everything you read so far, and even the little snippets that you had against the Saints, he looks like this guy is a monster. All right. Now, he hasn't done anything. I get it. And he's still got injury concerns. I get that too. But just the specimen and the way he operates on the field in practice, it's all you can go on now. He looks terrific to me. And he looks the part. He speaks the part. His work ethic is tremendous by all accounts. After practice, he's running gassers or 100-yard runs, whatever you want to call them, gassers. But, I mean, this guy has definitely made the Browns feel great about taking him number one overall.
Dennis Mandeloff joining us out of Cleveland, writes for the Cleveland Plain Dealer and for Cleveland.com. Okay, D-Man, let's get to the big story. Chris Sheridan, 18-year-plus NBA reporter and sports writer, said yesterday and just lit Twitter on fire, quote, NBA source said today, this will be LeBron's final season in Cleveland. He is 100% leaving. Relationship with owners beyond repair. Now, almost immediately, sources in Cleveland, including one of your colleagues, Joe Varden, said, my people close to LeBron say that is 100% false. Not true. Sheridan responded today, which I'm sure you're also well aware of, saying, follow-up tweet on LeBron James leaving Cleveland next summer. Denials from his reps are disingenuous. They will slash must lie to protect his image. Wow. That's a bombshell. Kyrie wants out, going to be traded. Yeah. And now confirmation from at least one source, citing other sources, saying LeBron is indeed out after next season. Your thoughts?
Honestly, Bob, I couldn't care less. And I know you're thinking that's bizarre coming from me, you know, the LeBron lover.
You mean couldn't care care if he leaves or not, or couldn't care about what this guy says?
I couldn't care less about the sourcing and the tweets and then this and then that. Of course I want to see LeBron play out his career, the rest of his career as a Cavalier. Absolutely. Nothing more enjoyable than watching LeBron in a Cavs uniform. But this soap opera crap, I've hit a wall. Or a breaking point. And not that anybody cares what I think, but I'm tired of it, okay? All right, so LeBron plays next season, 17-18, with the Cavaliers, and he leaves. God bless him. Thank you for the memories, LeBron. Have a good time wherever else you go. That means you would have given the Cavaliers 11 seasons. All right, 11. And you would have delivered a title, which this city didn't have for 52 years. I'm fine with that, okay? What I'm not fine with is the drama, the soap opera. The NBA has a PhD in soap operas and individual dramas that they milk so much, it gets nauseating. And this is going to be the.
So, do you see that what you're saying, that this is just a story to milk for pub, et cetera? Do you not take it seriously? And how should
Cavs of course I take it seriously. But I honestly think the Cavs fans have reached a breaking point along with me,
really?
Where we don't want to sit here and listen to this stuff. For how many more months is it going to be? 8, 9, 10 months before he leaves again?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, you reach a point where you're just like, okay, is it his last season or isn't it? I mean, we don't need to go through that emotional ringer anymore. It's like, you know, again, I can't say it sternly enough. I would like LeBron James to stay here. It is it's great for business, and I like the guy as a player. I want to see him as a Cav. But if he leaves, he leaves. This notion of, he's going and his refs. I mean, LeBron could put it all to bed, but he doesn't. And you know why? Because he probably doesn't know himself, okay? He probably honestly doesn't know for sure if he's leaving. And I'll tell you why he doesn't know for sure, in my opinion. Not a source, in my opinion. Because what happens if the Cleveland Cavaliers in 2017-18 play incredibly well and somehow, some way win the championship? What is he going to do after winning a title with the Cavaliers in 2018? Pack up and leave? No, I don't think he can, even though he would say, hey, I've done more than enough for you guys. It's kind of hard to walk away from a potential title defense, especially when you did it in Cleveland. So I don't believe LeBron has made up his mind. That's why he's told people such as Kyrie, hey, I don't know yet, okay? So why can't we just give that space, take the man at his word, let him play out the season and see what happens?
Let's take some of this with Kyrie. Kyrie, of course, has requested the trade. It has been speculated by many what his reasons are. He wants to be the man somewhere else and so on and so forth. I don't buy it. I never have. What I bought is that he wants out before LeBron goes, that he knows.
So do I.
He knows that he the last thing in the world he wants for his career as a budding superstar in this league is for LeBron to leave And then he's stuck, you know, in Cleveland. They don't go to the finals without LeBron, and he wears it all. Oh, you can't do anything without LeBron. You're overrated, blah, blah, blah. He doesn't want to be the guy kind of like following the guy. You don't want to be the guy following Tom Brady. You don't want to be the guy following John Elway and on down the line. So he figures, if I got to play without LeBron and try to win something on my own as the main guy, I'd rather be it somewhere else than in Cleveland, where of course, his shadow will always loom larger. But does that not give a little cred to the Sheridan sources thing? And, of course, LeBron's another, and I know you just complained about the drama and the sensationalizing of storylines, and I understand your point, but I got to bring it up anyway. The little cryptic, hey, next time I'm home in L.A., I'll stop up and see you, that he did about a week ago when somebody invited him to come up to their place in Washington. And people immediately said, wait, what? I thought home was Akron, Ohio. What are you talking about, home, L.A.? Next time I'm back home. So you take all of those things and add it up. The fans are probably still, even though you say they may be a little weary of this, if he is still indeed the best player in basketball, the best player on the planet, if you will, the idea that you're about to lose him for the second time in 7 years, well, 8 years, I guess, 2010 to 2018, to lose the best player in basketball for the second time in 8 years is going to be something that does weigh heavy on the fans for these next 8, 9, 10 months. And I think maybe getting to know that it's coming, softening the blow, is a little better than just being hit out of the blue the way they were on the day of the decision.
Yeah, and I hear you, Bob. And believe me, to pardon the pun, I'm not trying to be cavalier about my response.
There, I
to
laughed
this.
Out loud at that.
I'm not trying to be, you know, flippant about it. Like, of course we care around here. All right, believe me, and I stress that. Yes, it's important, and all that. I'm just railing against the drama and the soap opera that it continues to hang over this team where LeBron is concerned regarding his exit, his potential exit. And, you know, to me, it's going to make the 2017-18 season somewhat perhaps unenjoyable to watch, because it's going to be that slow march to the summer of 18. But my point is that I don't think that the fan base is going to feel jilted or going to feel horrible like it did the first time. Number one, because the decision is not going to occur, you know, in the way that it did the first time. But number two is that people, you know, appreciate 11 seasons and a title. And, what would it be? Well, I don't know what's going to happen in 18, but at the minimum four finals. You know, it's the greatest era in the history of Cavs basketball. The two eras, the two best eras are the ones he presided over. So I just don't think there's going to be this, you know, crazy anger about it this time around. And as a result, because I believe that, I'm not going to sit here and fret over it. You know, I'm going to appreciate what LeBron did. I'm going to hope that he plays great in 17-18. I'm going to hope the Cavs win the title because it's good for business. I don't have to root for him to say that, but it's good for business when you're a sports writer in this town if the home team does well.
Right on.
But I'm not going to sit here and like, oh, what's coming out of LeBron's camp today, or what did this guy say or that guy say? But I want to go back to something you referenced about Kyrie.
Before you do, do you think that attitude that you just described is different because the Warriors got Kevin Durant? What I mean by that, Dennis, is if they didn't look so invincible because they have Durant now and did what they just did in the finals and ran through the playoffs the way they did with one loss, do you think that Cavaliers fans being anticipatory of another championship, this is real, we could win another and maybe another and another, you know, we beat the Warriors once, we can beat them again, etc., the loss of a LeBron, you know, of LeBron leaving, you know, it would be a lot different if they felt like there was another championship that could be won. But now, because the Warriors look so dominant and unbeatable, it's like, well, if he leaves, you know, at least we're not going to be as mad as we were before. We enjoyed our little run. We got our championship.
I get it.
Do you see what I'm saying? Is it because the Cavaliers' expectations have been diminished now by the fact that there is an unbeatable opponent over there?
any fan worth his salt or her salt is going to say no. That's not an influencing factor. You never give an inch. You don't give in. But I get your point. And I do think that it has something to do with what I believe to be the overall attitude. Here I am trying to speak for the city. I don't know what the fan base is.
Well, I'll speak for me. I feel that way. If he was going to leave in the middle of a run where we felt like he could win more championships, I would feel very, very angry about that. But if I feel like they can't beat Golden State anyway, I may yawn at this and say, well, what's the difference if you lose in the playoffs or in the finals? You can't beat those guys. You know what I'm saying? I kind of guess I'm speaking for myself, but I wonder if other people feel the same way.
Yeah, let's say I would guess it's part of at least the subconscious mind, okay, where people realize, the fans realize, hey, have the Cavs done enough to overcome the Golden State Warriors? No, all right? Even if LeBron plays at the highest level he could possibly play, they still probably can't beat that fully loaded team when it's healthy. I think it's at least in the subconscious mind, if people don't think that, okay, if LeBron leaves, he's leaving a dynasty in the making, or a dynasty that is in the works or is happening in front of us. I get your point entirely. The Warriors' dominance might have, or probably has, something to do with the overall mindset.
Dennis Mandeloff, say hello to our man Kush.
What's going on? Oh, not too much. Thinking of all of this stuff tied together, we've been hearing reports for about a little over a week now that the Cavs are having trouble with the Kyrie deal, and part of it is because of what they're asking for. They want a specific kind of younger star, as if they're planning for a post-LeBron situation, almost assuming from their point of view he won't be back. Is that the right approach for the front office? I personally think yes, it is.
Yeah, it's a difficult question. That's a tough question, Kush. And listen, I don't envy ownership in front office, okay, in this case. I'm not the biggest Dan Gilbert fan. You guys know that. But I don't envy him in this case, he and Kobe Altman, because if you're Gilbert, you know you've got to get the King's ransom for Kyrie. In my opinion, if that deal was available, it would have happened by now. I know people are going to say, well, you're completely wrong about that. The time when the deal is going to get sweetened is closer to camp. I disagree. I think in the first few weeks after this meeting with Gilbert and Kyrie and the word got out, I think that was the time when the mega deal was going to strike. And because it isn't, I think it's more and more likely that Kyrie returns as a Cavalier, because he has the two more guaranteed years before the player option. But if you're Gilbert and Altman, the reason you're turning these proposals down is you don't think you're getting enough. But then you have to say, okay, what is enough? What constitutes enough? And that's to your point, Kush. Are you looking to get win now help? Well, of course they are. But you're also trying to get win later help, win in the future help, in addition to the win now stuff. And I think that's the wall that has been put up by the Cavaliers, and no one's meaning it. No other team is meaning it. No one other team is willing to give you anything close to dollar for dollar in your mind for Kyrie. So you sit there and you say, we're bringing him back. But if I were the Cavs, I would have to think long and hard about whether I should hedge, knowing that in 2018 it is very possible that LeBron James leaves.
Dennis Mandeloff breaking it down for us. Browns play the Giants in preseason game number 2 on Monday night. Cavaliers drama is indeed day-to-day, as the reports are that LeBron James is gone after this year. And, Dennis, really appreciate you breaking it down. As always, my friend, we'll talk to you again real soon.
Thanks, guys.
You got it. 4:03 now. Hour number 2 coming up after SportsCenter right here on ESPN 106.5. The Ticket.
I'm just railing against the drama and the soap opera that it continues to hang over this team where LeBron is concerned regarding his exit, his potential exit. And, to me, it's going to make the 2017-18 season somewhat perhaps unenjoyable to watch, because it's going to be that slow march to the summer of 18.
I definitely would expect probably Brock to win it, just because my personal philosophy is, as a quarterback, it takes at least 2 or 3 years to have a basic level of understanding of NFL defenses and offenses to be able to operate proficiently out there on the field, especially in week one. It'd be asking a lot. Now, I could be totally wrong. I might be going on a limb here, but I think that they're grooming Brock to be the starter in week one.
We know that the NFL and the NFLPA have a relationship that is at times and perhaps perpetually dicey and icy, and there's sometimes a lack of eye-to-eye between the NFL and the NFLPA. So it's scary to think that we are still almost 2 weeks away from the actual appeal from Zeke Elliott, and yet we are already having these words that are now in the court of public opinion and paint a very disconnected picture between the NFL and the NFLPA.
If domestic violence weren't so serious, this whole thing would be laughable. I mean, think about it. You've got the NFL, the masters of getting ahead of the story. Let's not forget Spygate, Bountygate, Deflategate. Now publicly accusing someone else of leaking information in a personal conduct case. I mean, it's just hard to wrap your head around that. But what's happening is the league wants to control the narrative as long as it can before Ezekiel Elliott's hearing at the end of the month. And remember, the league has been criticized for the way it has handled domestic violence cases in the past. Clearly, the league is sensitive to public perception here and is trying to win in the court of public opinion before the hearing comes down.
Now, you guys make all these predictions about everything, about guys that are going to be great players that have been here for 2 years, and who's going to win all the games, and I don't even know why we play. Why do we even play? Why do we even have practice? Why do we compete? Why do we coach guys? How do they need to improve? I mean, you guys got all the answers to how guys are going to be, what they're going to do. Sometimes I wonder, why do we play? Why do we even have practice? Because you guys got all these conclusions already drawn about who's what, how good they are, what they can do. Why would you ask me? I mean, I read stuff all the time like, well, that's nice to know. I mean, where'd that come from? And then you ask me? But Christian Miller has done a nice job. He's had a really good camp. He's doing a good job. Had a lot of production points in the scrimmage. We're really happy with the progress. And, you know, thanks for asking.
What are your impressions of how tonight went for you?
Bad. Pretty plain and simple. It didn't go well. We didn't pitch well. Home runs and walks are not a good combination. We're giving up too many of both. We got some young guys and bullpen some experience. That's about it. You look at our bullpen, it's extremely young. We got two guys with more than 3 years of service, and everyone else has got 1 year or less. There's going to be some growing pains, and we've seen some of those growing pains in the last couple of days. We don't have a lot of youngsters here. Dixon Machado's a youngster, but we're position players. We don't have a lot of youngsters. That's just the way it is. The staff in general has been way too much home run, too many home runs. That's not a recipe for winning.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
It is indeed, and it does continue now at 14 minutes after 4 o'clock. Thanks for being with us. Thanks to our friend Dennis Maniloff joining us. Talked a little bit about the Browns and about the Cavaliers with the trade rumor. Not the trade rumors, the leaving rumors of LeBron James. Now we'll talk trade rumors, because even though the trading deadline is gone in Major League Baseball, we saw what can happen in this waiver period, trading waiver period, as the Indians picked up Jay Bruce. And now, is it possible that longtime Detroit Tiger ace and fan favorite Justin Verlander could still indeed put on another cap before this season is over? And joining us now to talk baseball Tiger style with us from BlessYouBoys.com, Ashley McClendon makes her return here to Toledo. Thanks so much for joining us, Ashley. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm good. It's always good to talk baseball with you. We certainly appreciate that. You got a great website there that you contribute to. Let's talk about Justin. You wrote a piece about this yesterday. He admits, does JV, that the trade rumors are on his mind. Is this something that's affecting his performance? And what is, Ashley, his desire in this? Does he want to move someplace, or does he really want to settle in and finish his career in Detroit?
I think what we're seeing right now from Justin is a lot of, like, openness. He's did with the press lately when he's talking about these trade rumors and the feelings he has in regards to them. And he's opening up in that he's definitely thinking about them. And recently he said that there are things on his mind and dreams specifically, he said, that he's had that do come up for him now when he's thinking about these trade talks. And I think what
dreams
he means by that is, well, dreams, I think, in that I think there's things he hoped to accomplish in his career that he may not now be able to do if he sticks in a Tigers uniform.
Such
and I think specifically we're talking a World Series ring, yeah.
Yeah, of course.
So I think he's got to be thinking about that for sure.
the Astros, you referenced in your piece, obviously, the Astros, because they've been strongly, you know, tied to these talks to before the actual regular trading deadline. And as you point out, there's a lot of money involved here with Justin Verlander and a lot of prospects that the Tigers would like to get, and Houston really has no interest in giving up. So, I mean, is this just all a whole bunch of smoke where there's no fire like there was before the deadline?
Yeah, I think, and I mean, it's hard to say, because when you did ask me a month ago before the original trade deadline, I felt pretty strongly that there was a chance Verlander could move. And now I feel differently. I don't see Houston making the move. I think they're going to wait until the offseason, and you may see that move for next year. I don't see it happening now before the August 31st deadline, though.
Ashley McLennan joining us. Talk a little Tigers baseball here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. She writes for BlessYouBoys.com. Jim Cushlin is with us as always. Jimmy, go ahead.
And, you know, obviously Verlander and what might happen with him. There still could be something, as we're pointing out this month. Though I'm kind of with you, Ashley. I'm leaning against it, though it is worthy, again, of mentioning that the Astros, as I think they should be, are still at least trying to talk to the Tigers on this. But given the lostness of this particular season and how it's going so far, The Verlander thing can't be the only thing that happens in terms of this coming offseason. There's some of these other veterans. Something has to be done about some of them. Example, I don't think they should be picking up Ian Kinsler's option. I actually, if you're a big Tigers fan, you should actually twistedly be hoping that Justin Upton opts out so you don't owe him $22.5 million for the next 4 years after that. What should be done with some of these veteran contracts? Because I look at the payroll and all that stuff, and I think at bare minimum, Cabrera and his $30 million are still going to be here. Is Jordan Zimmer and his $24 million are still going to be here. And Victor Martinez and his $18 million are still going to be here. That's the minimum, and that's still a chunk of change. Do you think they should, and do you see them doing something about some of these veterans that they might be able to let go of this coming offseason?
I think they'll actually pick up Kinsler's option and then trade him, is how I see that going, personally. I see them making moves, but I feel like they're kind of stuck right now. I think the offseason is going to be interesting, but I thought they were going to do so much more at the trade deadline, and then they stuck. I thought, I don't know how slowly they're going to go about doing this. And I think you're right. I absolutely agree that moves need to be made. Those veteran guys need to be gone, but like you said, we're stuck with Zimmerman. We're stuck with Cabrera. There's no way we're getting rid of the last year of Victor Martinez, so we may as well just deal with it. So yeah, moving Kinsler's great, but if they can move him and get something back instead of just dropping his payroll, I think that's the smart move. So that's why I think they'll pick up his option and then trade him. But yeah, it's going to be an interesting off season, especially if they move, Verlander during the winter.
What's the confidence level that you have and that you sense maybe that, you know, the fans have, as you kind of have your finger on the pulse of them from you? Like, I'm looking at some of the comments under your column on Verlander, and right out of the gate, some fans are really critical of Avila, saying he doesn't know what he's doing, and then another one saying, yes, he does, it's not his fault, he inherited a mess here, a bloated payroll, aging team with a barren farm system, and all of these kinds of things. So from your evaluation and taking into account what you hear the fans saying, what's the confidence level here that Al Avila will get this thing built and turned around or not?
I think from a fan perspective, there's a lot of resistance against Avila and his ability, but I think from a logical perspective, which isn't to say the fans are illogical, but that they do have a passion involved in it that I think makes it difficult to see the finer details, is that he did do a lot of those deals in the Dombrowski era, and he saw the finer points of how that worked. And I think he's capable of it. I think there's just a lot that we're missing behind the scenes. Like, there weren't a lot of moves for infield players during the trade deadline, so it's easy for us to say that Jose Iglesias can move and Kinsler can move and they should have made those kinds of trades, but there weren't trades like that being made. So he probably had his finger on the pulse of what was happening and didn't see a return that he thought was going to be worth his while. So I think there's a little bit of both. I think there may be a lack of confidence, both on his part, in his ability to make those moves, and on the fan side, that he can make them. So I'm not sure what we're going to end up with, but I think it's going to be pretty telling this winter meetings as opposed to last year's.
He's being, Ashley McLennan is our guest from BlessYouBoys.com, Tiger Side on SB Nation, talking a little baseball. He's getting criticized, talking about Avila, and perhaps justifiably so by some in the media and certainly by some fans for the J.D. Martinez trade that they didn't get enough. Table scraps, some are saying. Do you think that he'd run the risk of trading Justin Verlander to a team like the Astros also for table scraps if it just meant getting rid of the contract, if it just meant saving the money so that they have more to work with as they try to rebuild this thing? Just, I mean, it's almost, I hate to say it with somebody like Justin Verlander, who has meant so much, you know, to the franchise and everything else, but addition by subtraction simply because of subtracting the contract, not the player.
Ooh, I think moving Verlander just to lose money is a dangerous thing, especially with the fan base. I think you run the risk of really alienating your core base when you get rid of a guy that's been with the team since 2005 just to cut $28 million a year, especially when you're not going to be using that money particularly right away to add any, like, they're not adding any expensive new talent. What they'll be looking for is young, relatively cheap, something they can keep under club control for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. And I think if they just, if Upton were to opt out and if they were able to move a Kinsler, they would have enough money to bring in that kind of inexpensive talent. So I think moving Verlander just to save money would be a terrible decision for the Tigers to make, and they would need to be sure that they're getting some kind of prospect value. But I think with the JD trade, even if you compare it to something like the Jay Bruce trade that we just saw, I think the Tigers came away pretty well getting three prospects. Lugo's looking like he could be like ready for the majors within a season and could come in and be this replacement second baseman when Kinsler goes. So I don't think it was as bad a trade as some people think it was.
You know, when you have the Jay Bruce trade to compare to, you might be right. That's a really good point because I think the Indians, well, we won't know if they fleece the Mets until we see how the 22-year-old pitcher that they sent over there, you know, turns out, and that'll be obviously years down the road. But you're right. It was a pretty small price for them to pay to get Jay Bruce, and at least the Tigers, when they did have to trade JD, got three prospects back. So that's a fair point, too. Ashley, do you believe that Verlander, again, going back to the article you wrote about him and he talked about the dreams, do you believe that was his way of saying, I want to trade, but he just doesn't want to be that guy who goes into the owner's office or to the GM's office and says, I want to trade, because it's going to go to the papers that way, it's going to go to the, you know, Detroit fans that way, that I want out of town? He wants it, but he can't say it other than, I have a dream of getting some of the things I've always wanted to do done?
I think there's an element of that there. I think he's being honest. I think he's opening up and saying, yeah, there are things that I wanted to do, things I wanted to accomplish that are on my mind. But he was also, in that same interview, he went on and said, while I'm here, this is my job, and this is what I'm going to do, and I'm going to do it the best I can. And I think what we're seeing from him, too, is that he wants to leave the Tigers in a positive way. So if he does get traded, he's spending so much time right now teaching things to the young pitchers on the team. He's giving pro tips to Verhagen and to Fulmer and to Norris, and he's really trying to nurture that base that's going to be there for the Tigers for years to come. So I think even if he does want to leave the team, there's an element of him that wants to make sure that it's set up in such a way that they can succeed even without him.
I think that's a pretty good analysis because, you know, Justin's obviously a classy guy and he cares about the fans and how they view him. As well as how they view the franchise as well. Jimmy, go ahead.
You know, the flip side to all this, of course, though, is considering where everything is, are some of these prospects, particularly some of the ones that they did get back. You mentioned Dal Lugo. Then there's also a Candelario, who, of course, did have a cup of coffee, couple at bats the very, very recently. We're 15 days away from being able to expand rosters for September call-ups. Do you wait until September 1st to call up these guys, or do you find some way to say, you know, the heck with it? Let's start bringing them up now if we – the couple that they do have, I know Dixon Machado's there right now, and that's another example. But should they start bringing some of these guys up, even if it means, say, I couldn't help but notice that there was another story the other day about Miguel Cabrera's back acting up on him, missed a couple games, he's back. But in a way, do you just say, you know what, Miggy? We're putting you on the DL so we can bring some of these kids up, and then it'll be fine. We have expanded rosters into September. Basically, what I'm saying is, should they start bringing some of these kids up now, what they do have, that is?
I don't think they're going to. I think it would be nice in the sense that it would give kids that are almost ready for the bigs, and like you look like a Candelario who is. He's absolutely already ready to play in the majors, and you're getting reps for guys like Machado, but I don't see them doing it just because they do run things fairly old school in the call-up system for the Tigers. They're pretty set in that way. So, yeah, even though I agree that Miguel probably should be benched a little longer because he is clearly injured and nobody's saying anything about it, you're not going to see those call-ups until September, as far as I can tell.
Now, the flip side of this, one prospect, quote-unquote, he doesn't really have that term anymore, that I don't think any Tigers fan will cry over if they don't see him again, Bruce Rondon, who failed yet again. He's back in Toledo. Randomly sounds simple question, but it may not be. Is this the last we've seen of Bruce Rondon in a Detroit Tigers uniform?
I mean, it's hard to say. He's had so many chances and been given so many opportunities with the team. And first it was a lack of commitment and a bad attitude. And then I think that the Tigers handled Rondon as well as they could to give him as many chances as they could. Like, they made it fairly clear that they wouldn't put up with his BS and that he needed to be a team player. And it seemed like he got that memo right away, but the way he's been playing, he's by no means meeting the expectations that the team had for him. I don't know if it's the last we've seen of him just because of how run down the Tigers' pen is, that there's not a lot for them to choose from. But given his performance, I think they'd have to be running pretty desperate to bring him back up.
Ashley, last thing, and we'll let you jet. Thanks again for the time. Since last we spoke, some things have changed a little bit in the American League, in the standings. I mean, the Astros were kind of running away with things. They hit a little bit of a skid. They had some injury problems as well. The American League East has kind of flipped a little bit, too. The Yankees were kind of riding high. Now the Red Sox have a relatively comfortable lead there of 4.5 games. And the Indians have opened up, 5.5 now on the Royals. They're leading in the first game of this doubleheader with the Twins. So that'll be 7 on the Twins if they finish this first one off. Who's the best team in the American League?
That's a tough call. The Red Sox have been great and have probably one of the best pitching rotations right now. Man, the Indians are really making a push for it, aren't they? And I want to give you guys that one because you're in Ohio, right?
Yeah. And Jim and I are both grew up Cleveland Indians fans, so we do want to see.
And then you got and Miller's coming back, so Miller's coming back, so that'll be huge for the Pens.
That will be huge. Yeah, Lonnie Chisenhall was leading the team in RBIs when he went down onto the DL. He's going to be coming back soon as well. But I mean, even without some of those guys, their pitching has just been electric. Their starting rotation from Kluber, who's a Cy Young candidate with Sale, to Carrasco, who started today, struck out 9 in 5 innings, to Trevor Bauer, who's won 4 straight starts, to Danny Salazar, who came back off of the disabled list and from a stint in Columbus to be just lights out as well. I mean, everybody is dealing for them. And the acquisition of Jay Bruce, as you know, gave a big lift to the middle of that lineup, too. So I'd like to think the Indians might be the best team in the American League, but I'm not going to ask you to say that. I'd like a real objective analysis.
I'd say the Astros probably still have it right now, but the Indians are definitely proving themselves to be the team that everyone thought that they would be in the Central, which is great because after a sluggish start, it wasn't 100% that they were going to live up to the expectation, but I definitely think they're going to run away with the division.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say, too. And, like I said, the Astros they were just the opposite. Instead of a sluggish start, they got off to a ridiculous start the first, 2.5-3 months. And then they hit, like I said, a little bit of a bad run. They lost, 2-4, I think 6 in a row, a streak that just kind of ended a couple of days ago. Now they've won 3 out of their last 4. So, they're vulnerable as well. And the Red Sox and the Yankees continue to beat each other up there in the East as well. So, Lord only knows. Is Chris Sale the Cy Young winner, by the way, if the season ended right now, or is it Kluber, or is it really too close to call?
I think Sale has it if it were to end right now, but I would like to see Kluber get it instead.
He's got one.
Personal bias.
He would like another, and there has not been a better pitcher in baseball. In that, of course, is easier to say because Kershaw's been down, but there's not been a better pitcher in all of baseball than Kluber since June 1st. His numbers are off the charts. Strikeouts, ERA, whip, I mean, just about everything. He has just been locked in since he came off the DL on June 1st in 14 starts. So, yeah, but then again, Chris Sale has been his equal. He is, he's putting up crazy starts and crazy stretches as well.
He's been so good this season.
Yeah, he really has been. Some are saying that not only is Chris Sale the MVP, that's the reason I asked what your thought was. Not only is he the Cy Young Award winner, probably, but he could very well win both and win the MVP, too.
Ooh, that would be an interesting one. I mean, Trout's probably lost it just because he was down for so long. And I know a lot of people were saying Judge kind of had a lock on it because of his early start, but he's floundering lately, so there's an argument there for Sale for sure.
Yeah, did he just not set a record of striking out in his 34th or 35th consecutive game? It's the longest streak in the modern era for a non-pitcher.
It's a ridiculous run, which is strange, and people, of course, are going to blame the home run derby for any failings at this point because it's a curse, and everyone loves curses in baseball.
That's very true, and, you know, despite that major slump of his, he still is leading the American League in home runs with 37. Nobody's caught him yet despite that prolonged power outage and obviously just kind of swinging and missing with reckless abandon. Great stuff. Ashley McLennan, read her stuff online at blessyouboys.com. That's a part of SB Nation. If you're a Tigers fan, you don't want to miss that. Ashley, thanks so much for the time. We appreciate it.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
You got it. Always a pleasure. Good stuff from Ashley McLennan. All right. Here's what we're going to do. Bottom of the hour, we're going to take time out here for SportsCenter. On the other side, we're going to see what people are saying and maybe see what you are saying. Did Urban Meyer hurt his former All-American running back, Ezekiel Elliott, when he answered a question during an interview about Ezekiel Elliott's troubles and his 6-game suspension, sounding like Elliott really is in some trouble?
Love Zeke.
All right, I can't really play that for you unless this part is connected. Here we go.
Love Zeke. I talk to his family more often than Zeke. We all want what's best for him. I worry about him. I worry about the fact that I don't know all the stories about the accusations, but I'm always warning our team about that. When you become that kind of person, you have to really be cautious who you're around and who you're with, and I just worry about him.
When you become that kind of person, you have to be cautious about who you're around, and I just worry about him. Some are saying that that cautious tone expressed by Urban Meyer, a man who is a very high-profile guy, could weigh on the minds of those who are deciding Ezekiel Elliott's fate in the National Football League, including the arbitrator, Harold Henderson, who will hear the appeal of his 6-game suspension. Want to get your reaction to that? I've got a few of my own and a few other media types that we'll share with you as well as we continue right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
The Extravaganza right now by calling 866-240-1065. Now back to the Bob France Extravaganza on 106.5 The Ticket.
Rolling on, are we at 441 right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. So what do you think? And thanks again, by the way, to our guest Ashley McLennan and to Dennis Mandeloff joining us in the last couple of segments about various things on the local and national scenes. But what do you think about Urban Meyer? Urban Meyer said the following yesterday in response to a question about Ezekiel Elliott, who has a 6-game suspension from the NFL for violation of the league's personal conduct policy, but specifically for domestic violence. And the evidence that they say they uncovered that proves that he beat his then-girlfriend Tiffany I believe it was McMahon, I can't remember her name. I apologize. I don't have the story in front of me because I'm just going by memory. But anyway, he beat his then-girlfriend several times over the course of a one-week period last July. And it was a year-long investigation that resulted in this 6-game suspension. And Urban Meyer was asked about Zeke, and he had this to say.
Love Zeke. I talk to his family more often than Zeke. We all want what's best for him. I worry about him. I worry about the fact that I don't know all the stories about the accusations, but I'm always warning our team about that. When you become that kind of person, you have to really be cautious who you're around and who you're with, and I just worry about him.
Tiffany Thompson, by the way, is the girl's name. So Urban Meyer said, when you become that kind of a person, let's hear that part again.
Always warning our team about that. When you become that kind of person, you have to really be cautious who you're around and who you're with, and I just worry about it.
Some are saying that is very, very coded language for, I think he probably did this, and I'm very worried about him because I'm worried about what this is going to do to him in his career. He's, he has said some things now and done some things here that are, that are going to get him in a whole lot of trouble. It almost is kind of like implicating him, saying, I don't believe the appeal that he has filed. I don't believe that he should get out of this, that I'm very worried about him, that there are some reasons to be concerned about this. So there are a lot of other people who are weighing in on this, and one of them I would like you to hear is Stephen A. Smith, who said on the TV on ESPN television today, which of course is his program First Take, who said Urban Meyer is not doing Ezekiel Elliott, his teammate, any favors. Why? Because, well, Urban Meyer is a trusted figure, a trusted public figure who knows Ezekiel Elliott very well. He recruited him. He coached him, and that if he's really worried about him, then maybe there's a reason to be worried about him. Maybe there is something to what the NFL found. Here's what Stephen A. said, and I want to get your thoughts if we can. All right, Stephen A. is suddenly very silent. My apologies for this. We'll try to make this work. I got a little bit of a tech glitch here on the audio cut, and yeah, all right, that's super. It played during the commercial break, and now it won't play when I want to hear it. I will have to paraphrase it for you. Essentially what...
And to make Zeke look.
Yeah, here we go.
It don't make him look great. It doesn't make him look great. And I'm sure, I want to emphasize, I'm quite sure that wasn't Urban Meyer's intent, and I'm quite sure he was just answering a question that was just asked to him. I understand that. But considering what Ezekiel Elliott has just had handed to him, a six-game suspension, the fact that he is about to appeal it, the fact that the Players Association, which, by the way, ironically defends him, but I haven't heard them speaking in defense of Colin Kaepernick that much, by the way, but that's a different story for another day. The point that I'm trying to make to you is that the timing of these words, I don't want to go as far as to say it indicts Ezekiel Elliott, but it's indicative of those around him feeling he's a troubled soul, which doesn't reek anything towards innocence in any way, which means that it does not help him. Again, I want to emphasize, I'm quite sure that wasn't Urban Meyer's intent. But when you consider what's going on with Ezekiel Elliott, and then you combine that with the timing of this quote from his college coach at Ohio State, then what we're seeing and what we're hearing is that he's a troubled soul who needs our help, which is indicative of an individual with problems. And that's not the kind of thing that Ezekiel Elliott and the Players Association is trying to give off about him.
I was glad to hear this today because, Jim, it's what I started to say yesterday at the end of our show, kind of like close to where we are now.
Yeah.
That when I heard Urban Meyer's commentary, and we played that in yesterday's montage, so we're kind of going back a little bit. But when I heard that in yesterday's montage, the comments from Urban Meyer said that does not sound good for Ezekiel Elliott. It just doesn't make him sound like. In other words, what Ezekiel Elliott needed there from Urban Meyer was a statement that said, yes, I know Zeke very well. I recruited him. I coached him. And I find it extraordinarily difficult to believe that he would do anything even close to what the NFL is alleging that he has done. Perhaps the league should take a lead from the prosecutors and the Columbus Police Department, which decided not to press any charges here. I just am extraordinarily disappointed that the NFL would take this leap and punish Ezekiel Elliott for something that I don't believe the young man is capable of. That's what you wanted to hear if you're Ezekiel Elliott from Urban Meyer. And instead, Urban Meyer gave something very, very different. One more time. Real
love Zeke. I talk to his family more often than Zeke. We all want what's best for him. I worry about him. I worry about the fact that I don't know all the stories about the accusations, but I'm always warning our team about that. When you become that kind of person, you have to really be cautious who you're around and who you're with. And I just worry about him.
So what are what's your take on that, Kush? Is I don't want to say that Urban is throwing Zeke under the bus. Not at all. Maybe the reason why Urban is saying what he is saying is because it's real, because it's true, because he feels like, yeah, I do know Zeke, and I do worry about him, and I do worry about the kind of quote-unquote person that he can become, or maybe that he has
become. That kind of person, you have to really be cautious.
When you become that kind of person, that maybe Urban doesn't want to lie. Maybe Urban doesn't want to answer the question that I can't ever believe Ezekiel Elliott could do something like this, and then come to find out that he did do something like this and then hurt his own credibility. Maybe this is the only thing that Urban Meyer could say because it was truth. And Urban knows Ezekiel Elliott enough to know that he could very well be a violent guy.
Right, and certainly Urban Meyer is not going to put himself in a position where later things would come out and people would have to ask him, so did you, you know, lie to us when you were talking about Zeke earlier?
Right.
But at the same time, you're kind of pointing this out, Stephen A., in the clip you played kind of point out, this is not a good look from an Ezekiel Elliott point of view. What Urban Meyer is saying, it does not look good at all. And it also makes me wonder, as this thing keeps going forward, because there's obviously still going to be an end to this whole thing.
Yeah.
We have to find out what the appeal is going to end up doing and things like that. But the more and more I look at it, the more I think, because another thing we talked about, we brought a little bit of this up yesterday, was how now the NFL and the NFLPA are getting into literal Twitter spats against each other over this.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, nasty ones.
It makes me think, if you're the NFLPA, the way this is progressing, don't go die on that hill. Don't. It'll be bad for you and therefore the rest of the players going forward.
You mean the Players Association should die on this hill?
Yes.
Well, I don't think they have a choice. We talked about this again with Adam
Stretch
a little bit yesterday.
Don't.
What's that?
You're right. To a degree, they don't have a choice. That's their job.
It is literally their job to represent a member in good standing of their union. Unions, you know, I mean, let's be honest. Unions are very, very powerful. I don't want to get into the political side of unions, although there is something there I've talked about in the past. But, you know, the UAW, you could have an employee who is fired for not doing his job, for sleeping on the clock, for completely missing his quota on the line at the Jeep plant. You could have an employee get fired for a variety of reasons, or fined or docked or whatever, and the union that represents him has a duty, an obligation, to go to bat and defend his lazy, sleeping on the job, not doing his quota, you know, abusing sick time, whatever it is that he's been in. They have to defend him and try to get him his job back, even if they know he's wrong. To that end, I don't know if the NFLPA can do anything but die on the hill for Ezekiel Elliott. Even if they know Zeke saw the pictures, and they said they know Zeke did this, they have to find a way to fight for him, because for the same reason, Jim, and I know I'm going to get a little off into the legal weeds here, but for the same reason a defense attorney has to defend,
where you're going
to
go.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Has to defend somebody that's on camera robbing a liquor store. That defense attorney has to try to find a way to get that person off despite the mountain of evidence and the knowledge that they did it, because the idea is to make sure the burden of proof is so high on the prosecution so that the next time somebody who is innocent but looks really, really guilty doesn't get railroaded into prison. They have to make the system as foolproof as possible. So the union in some ways is a defense attorney here, and they've got to defend Ezekiel Elliott to the very limits of the law and the limits of the CBA. Even if they die on the hill and he is still, you know, the 6-game suspension is upheld, they will have made the process work better for the next guy.
Yeah.
They might not be able to save Ezekiel Elliott, but what they do here might help them the next time around, and also help them craft the language of the personal conduct policy and the next CBA a little bit better, to maybe say, you know what, Goodell, you don't get to do all of this judge, jury, executioner. We have to create a panel. Whatever it is they do, they have to fight really, really hard for Elliott to make it better for the next guy around.
And you are correct in all that. That is their job as the Players Association. But the extracurriculars going on with this particular one, like, for example, again, the Twitter spat with the NFL itself, if you're the NFLPA, cut that nonsense out right now. Because the public perception is really going to turn on you on this one, because this is again, what's going on here for Ezekiel Elliott, of course, is the domestic violence thing, and we know that the NFL has messed those up before, and they don't want to be messing it up again.
No, of course not, and they also don't want to seem weak on something like this.
Sure.
And again, I keep saying this for the last 4 days. If the evidence that they say they have is legit, if it's real, the photos and this and that and the other proving he did these things, and they don't give him the maximum you can under the terms of the CBA, the maximum number of games, which is 6, for a first offense of their first violation of the personal conduct policy, They're going to look bad again.
Yep.
If they go soft on him and give him two games or three games or something and say, hey, the courts didn't do it, so therefore we're not going to, and then the photos get out, and or he does it again, or whatever the case might be, that makes them look like, holy cow, they gave their superstar, you know, offensive rookie of the year guy, et cetera, they gave him the benefit of the doubt again. They didn't take the side of the victim. They took the side of their superstar player, and it makes them look even worse. So they have to.
Yes.
Again, if they just as the union has to play defense attorney here, the NFL, Roger Goodell, in the front office, they really, truly have to go as hard as they can against him, just if the evidence is real,
yeah,
just
you're right,
because they know what it's going to
happen. You're absolutely right, because from the NFL's point of view, they cannot seem soft in the public, you know, perception on this. They cannot seem soft on this one.
Yeah, no question about it. Jimmy is in Toledo. Let's squeeze him in here before the top of the hour, and Drive Time coming your way right here on the Ticket. Hey, Jimmy, go ahead.
Well, first of all, about Urban Meyer, I think maybe he could have been a little more clear when you're that kind of person. Maybe he means from the time he coached him, now Zeke's a multi-millionaire bachelor who's no longer being supervised by a coaching staff as far as college. He no longer has that structure. He doesn't have his father coming from Missouri, you know, and then basically being there for him through college. He's basically on his own, and he's got millions and millions of dollars and probably has a posse. And he needs to watch who he's with, because as we found out, like Johnny Manziel, a lot of these young guys, they get a lot of people around them that are there for the ride and the party. And it's like
don't
a lot
have
of these
his best interest at heart. That's very
right.
True.
And truthfully, a lot of these guys have a lot of money, and I'm not trying to link this to the case, but there's a type of rebellion that might go on. They've ever since they were probably 8 years old, they've had this dream of pro football, and they've probably been these athletes, and it's been this like almost tunnel vision thing to go to where they live this dream and get to the league. And now they've done it, and now they've got no college, nothing. They've got the millions, they've got the contract, and now they're set loose, and they've got time on their hands. So, that's kind of some of the stuff that, you know, concerns me about Zeke. But what really bothers me is like this process with the NFL, and you said a lot of it could be like, there's like a lot of selective leaks, and they're using this to kind of like counterbalance their own agenda with the public after the Ray Rice thing. And it's like, well, who's acting on Zeke's best interest? Who's representing him? Because the police
somebody is, because there's leaks coming out from that side as well about this. You know, hey, she wants to talk
about
a friend
the problem.
And said,
hold on, Bob.
With a sex tape or something
okay.
like that.
But what I'm talking about in the fact finding process, there's nobody exactly there acting on Zeke's behalf. Nobody deposing the witness, like in a trial, asking questions on Zeke's behalf. It's all being done from the perspective that Zeke's kind of guilty from the outset, and it's kind of like a civil suit where we only have to find the preponderance of the evidence, and there's really nobody, like from a legal standpoint, representing Zeke in deposing the witness, so to speak. And you're really only getting like one side of the story, and it's like the NFL seems like they're busy trying to leak out a certain side of the story.
I don't know if that's the case, because I don't know if his agent...
Well, obviously it is, because that's...
Hold on. I don't know if his... I mean, I have to believe that every step of this investigation for the last year, they have been in contact with Zeke's representation. Not a lawyer, but an agent, publicist, whomever it is that represents, and probably the Dallas Cowboys. They are the ones who are going to be speaking for Zeke. Hey, this is what we find. We need to talk to you about this. Hey, this is what we found. We need to talk to you about this. I don't
know
the details of the investigation, and neither do you, and that's why we have to wait and see.
Here's the thing. You know what I find interesting about this?
Yeah.
The woman herself hasn't pressed charges, and she hasn't filed a civil lawsuit.
Well,
so how the hell does anybody know? You know, it's like... What's actually been, what legal proceedings have there actually been? Who's actually been put under oath and deposed?
You don't need to be under oath.
Look,
if you're found hanging outside a known drug house, you know, a crack house. You don't have to be found with crack. You don't have to be found testing positive. You don't have to be caught in the middle of a buy. But if you hang out there often enough and it looks really bad, they can suspend you for violating the personal conduct policy.
Okay, now here's
nothing has to happen there. That's the thing.
Okay, now here's the problem, and here's the problem I have with it, Bob, that this is all being done in public, and the NFL's doing this for an image thing, and they'll say, look at us, look how we're... This should all be handled in private, because you don't know what happened. I don't know what happened.
Now, I would disagree with you on that, too, Jimmy. Everything was done in private until the announcement of the suspension. That had to be made public. And then when the media said, wait, six games, why? They had to publicly say, well, here's what we found.
Even before the suspension was announced, we've been getting leaks out of the NFL about this.
You know what we can do? We can talk more about this tomorrow on our Free For All Friday program, my man, because I've got to run. Mr. Miller will not wait. Drive Time is coming up next right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Free For All Friday tomorrow. We'll see you then. Bye.